Osho, the invitation. Responses to disciples' questions given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 22.
Beloved Bhagwan, this question is asked by a trembling heart, written by a trembling hand. My gratitude feels so inadequate for your gift. Why do I feel so unworthy of you?
There are certain symptoms of falling in love. One of them is a feeling of unworthiness, because love is so vast. And you are so small, and you cannot earn love. It comes on its own accord. Suddenly it starts showering on you. Naturally, because you have not earned it, you cannot feel worthy of it. As love deepens, the feeling of unworthiness deepens. If a person in love does not feel it, that means the love is superficial and the man has too big an ego. Only in that situation, when your ego is too big and your love is a superficial affair, not the great affair Tahui was talking about, before the great affair of love, it is absolutely necessary and inevitable that one should feel unworthy. Nothing is wrong in it. It is exactly as it should be. Out of this unworthiness, slowly, slowly, a transformation happens. I can predict it will happen to you too. Because your feeling of unworthiness is not just an intellectual question. Intellect never asks such questions. Ego does not allow such questions. Mind is not capable of asking such questions. Mind and ego and intellect, they all take it for granted. Whatever happens in their life is not enough. They are worthy for more. Hence, the question cannot arise from those sources. The only source remains is the heart, which is always true and always sincere. And once the heart starts feeling unworthy, it does not give a sadness to you, but a gratefulness. Slowly, slowly, unworthiness turns into gratitude. You are not worthy of something, and it has been sovereign on you. You cannot even understand why existence has chosen you. One of Gautam Buddha's disciples, Manjushri, became enlightened sitting under the tree. The moment he became enlightened, suddenly flowers from the tree started showering on him. Those who were around, they could not believe what is happening, because there is not any strong wind. There is no reason why so many flowers go on showering on Manjushri. And he is sitting silently with closed eyes. Perhaps he is not even aware. They reported to Gautam Buddha. He looked where Manjushri was sitting under a tree, and he said, "He has become what his destiny was. He has come to his flowering. And not only his inner being is full of joy, even the tree is celebrating." These kinds of stories have been taken for centuries as metaphors, poetry, beautiful anecdotes. But now we can say they are factually possible on scientific grounds, because trees are very sensitive. More sensitive than you are. They join you in your celebration. They join you in your mourning. Of course, you are not aware. But now scientists have profound ways to figure out. They have made a small instruments like cardiogram, which is attached to the tree. And the cardiogram starts working, making the graph of the tree's sensitivity. When the tree is at ease, relaxed, the cardiogram makes a graph very symmetrical. And if a woodcutter comes with his axe with the idea to cut the tree, he has not started cutting and he has not even told that he is going to cut the tree. But if he has the idea, the tree is even sensitive to the idea. And suddenly the graph starts trembling, just like your heart is trembling, writing your hand is trembling, the whole tree starts deep down trembling, and it can be caught on the graph. The graph is no more symmetrical. It goes crazy. And not only that tree which has to be cut becomes aware of your thought. Your thought creates a vibration around you, which a simple heart can catch hold of it. Other trees surrounding the tree, friends and companions, have been together for years, have joined in sadness when there was no rain, has joined when the rain comes and brings great joy and blessings, have passed through many falls and seen themselves standing naked against the sky, and have seen many springs together. When great foliage comes and when flowers start blossoming, a certain communion, a certain friendliness has arisen in them. So it has been found that the tree which is going to be cut, it starts trembling, catches the thought, but other trees nearby also start trembling. Just the idea that one of their old friends is going to be destroyed . Strangely enough, scientists have been shocked that it means trees are more sensitive than human beings. You don't know what the thought is going on in the person who is sitting by your side. But every Mind is broadcasting its thoughts all around. And you are catching, but you are not aware. They have tried that the same woodcutter is brought again, but with no idea of cutting the tree. With his axe he comes, the graft continues exactly the same symmetrical, showing that the tree is not worried, because there is no idea in the woodcutter. And the other trees also stop trembling. And when the gardener has been brought, who has nourished those trees, cared for them, has loved them, in lonely moments has even talked with them, because I had a gardener, an old man, a very beautiful man. And he was not just professionally a gardener. He loved trees. I have seen him when there was nobody and he thought nobody is watching him. I have seen him talk to the trees. Once I caught hold of him, because he was continuously winning every year. Almost 5 years he was with me. Every year he was winning the corporation prize for bringing the biggest roses. And I asked him, what the matter, you talk with the tree? He said, I love them. I feel them. I can tell you, but not to anybody else, because I trust you will understand that it is not one-sided. They also answer in some way or other. And I have been winning these prizes not because I am a great gardener. The city was big and there were many millionaires in the city. They had great gardens and many gardeners, and they were all puzzled because they were all trying to win the prize. But this old man went on winning. He said, it is just my talking to the trees. Then don't forget in the right time to give me the biggest flower. It is a question of my prestige and your prestige. And he said to me that it has never failed. Those gardeners are doing hard work, more manure, more chemicals. They are doing everything that the art of gardening will suggest. This is beyond art of gardening. As the gardener is brought, all the trees immensely feel so happy that the symmetrical graph becomes almost a dance, just as has become crazy out of fear, out of love, it again becomes not the ordinary silent tree, but showing a tremendous joy, as if the tree is jumping, dancing. And you can see the difference between the graphs. When the tree is afraid, the graph will show you that these lines are coming out of fear. And when the tree has suddenly seen the gardener who has taken care and grown it up like his own children, the graph dances. And you can see in the graph that it is not out of worry, but out of a gratitude and out of a welcome. A friend has come, and other trees also go the same. Man is capable of receiving immense joy if he only learns how to be grateful. So you are on the right path, Vidhan, but don't go on thinking in terms that you are unworthy. Because that has to be transformed into gratitude. It is certain nobody is worthy. What you have done to be alive, what have you done to have such beautiful eyes? What have you done to have this potentiality of becoming a Gautam Buddha? You have not done anything. It is just coming out of the abundance of existence. Existence has so much that it has to share out of sheer necessity to unburden itself. It is overflowing. And if people remain thirsty, it is their own fault. There is an ancient saying in India that you can remain thirsty standing on the bank of a river, unless you learn how to bow down, fill your hands with water. The river is not going to jump towards you. It is available. Just a little humbleness on your part, a little receptivity on your part, and you can quench your thirst. Everything that is great in life is abundantly available. Just don't shrink in your unworthiness. It is a beautiful first step to experience it. But then, for what we are worthy? Neither for life, nor for love, nor for this beautiful body. We are not worthy for anything. We have just taken all this granted. This is the irreligious mind. I don't call a man irreligious who does not believe in God. I don't call a man irreligious who does not go to the temples or churches. I don't call a man irreligious if he denies heaven and hell and all that nonsense. But I call a man irreligious if he does not feel unworthy of all that he has received and is receiving every moment, with every breath, with every heartbeat. Life is continuously giving you. The same life is capable of giving you immense blissfulness of which you cannot even have an idea unless you have tasted it. Just change your unworthiness into gratefulness, into thankfulness. And to me, this kind of gratitude is the only true prayer. You don't have to say anything. Just the feeling of gratefulness that I don't deserve. I don't see why so much has been given to me and so much goes on souring on me. What can I do except be grateful? This gratefulness should sink deep in your consciousness, in your very fibers and cells of body. You will simply become gratefulness. Then it is prayer. And the things that are called prayer are just false. Millions of temples and churches and synagogues and millions of people continuously praying, but their prayers are false because they are always asking for something. They are never thanking for what they have already received. In their prayers, if you look, you will find the beggar. And ungrateful beggar. And you will also find in all the prayers of all the religions, I have looked as deeply as possible into every religion, there is a certain complaint that things are not as they should be. That others are getting more, I am not getting that much. These are not prayers. They are simply wasting their time. They have not even come to understand the meaning of prayer. It is not in the words. It is prayerfulness. And prayerfulness means only one thing and only one thing: gratefulness. A gratitude that goes on sinking deep into your being. For everything, for trees being green, for rain coming down to quench the thirst of the earth. And when the first rains come, the sweet smell coming from the earth is earth's gratitude. And the trees becoming green and bringing millions of flowers, that is earth's thankfulness. That is earth's prayer. That's how you should be. That's how your prayer should be. Nothing but a gratefulness. Slowly, slowly, man goes on forgetting what complaint is, what grudge is. As he becomes more attuned with gratefulness, he forgets completely that he has to ask for something. Things are coming without his asking. Just he has to keep his doors open and the guest comes. He has just to wait, and wait lovingly, prayerfully. I am giving you the meaning of prayer in a way no religion has ever given it to humanity. Their prayers are so childish. It's stupid. A gratefulness will make you more and more capable of receiving gifts. The so-called religions that have overruled man's mind for centuries are mostly fictions. I have come across Albert Camus. A very strange but beautiful and true statement. If God did not exist, we would have to invent Him. Otherwise, whom you are going to complain? On whose shoulders you are going to throw all your responsibilities? With whom you are going to be angry? Who is going to be your security, safety? Camus is saying something very important when he says, if God did not exist, we would have to invent Him. And if God did exist, we would have to abolish Him. Why, if God did exist, we would have to abolish Him? Because it will be intolerable. To be so grateful to Him, would look like humiliation. That you are unworthy and He goes on giving to you. You cannot forgive Him. He is insulting you. He is making you aware of your unworthiness. I have a friend who was at a time education minister. He used to come to me once in a while. And one day he told me, something that he would not have told anybody, that I have thought many times to bring to your notice, but then I stopped myself. But there is a limit. I have to tell it to you. He was born a poor man, and he was adopted by a rich man, very rich man, who had no children. So he suddenly got from poverty to be a super rich man. And he started giving money to his relatives. Who were poor, because he himself belonged to a poor family. His relatives were poor, his friends were poor, and now he had so much, and he has got it without any effort. And he was in a position to help everybody, and he really helped all his relatives, his father, his brother, his sisters, his friends, and he made all of them very rich. I was aware of the fact he told me that the problem is, I have been so generous to everybody who was even far away connected, a far away cousin, or just an acquaintance. But if I saw that they were in trouble, I gave them as much as they wanted. I gave them more. Now they are all flourishing. They are all rich. But one thing is strange, that they don't feel obliged towards me. On the contrary, most of them never come to see me or meet me. In fact, they avoid me. It hurts me very much that I have done so much. And what kind of ungrateful people are these? I said, you don't understand the deeper psychology behind it. You have given them, but you don't know that the giver always insults to the person he is giving. In the very giving, you have become higher, and the person who has received becomes lower. If you are an understanding man, this is actually what will happen. I want to ask one thing to you. Have you ever taken any help from them? He said, I don't need. Why should I take their help? I said, that's where you are humiliating them, insulting them. What is wrong? It's small things. If you just phone a friend whom you have helped, who is now rich, has a factory of his own, cars of his own, if you just ask him that, send two cars, I need very much. You may not need, you have enough cars. And you just let those cars come and after an hour send back. You don't need. But let that man feel that he can also give something to you. That he is not always on the receiving end. He is sometimes on the giving side also. Or you can tell to some friend that in your garden I saw so beautiful roses. Can you send me a dozen roses today? And he will be immensely happy to send those dozen roses. It doesn't cost him much, but he will start forgiving you and he will start being grateful to you. The man said, perhaps you are right. I have never asked anybody for anything because I don't need. And I never thought that just giving to somebody, and always giving, and never taking anything, anything without any value, few flowers, are just calling the person that I am feeling very lonely, can you come and be with me for the breakfast or for the lunch? I will be immensely grateful. You would have helped those people to regain their dignity. You have given them money, but you have made them beggars, and nobody can forgive you. This is utterly inhuman. And he said, I understand. But I will not be able to do it. It is against my ego. I said, that is then absolutely clean why they are avoiding you. They know that you are giving them not because they are poor, but because you are rich. You are not concerned with problems and worries and difficulties. You are just exploiting their misery, their suffering, their poverty for your own ego fulfillment. That I have done great help. And you are bragging continuously. How can they forgive you? That's what Albert Camus means when he says, if God did exist and was available to humanity, we should have to abolish him because it will become intolerable. He goes on giving and he will not ask for anything from you because he has everything. The whole belongs to him. He will take away all your dignity. You can forgive somebody for anything, but you cannot forgive anybody who destroys your dignity as a human being, who takes away your pride. Fortunately, there is no God. And particularly for you, because there are people who believe in God. Deep down, they are angry with Him. They may pray and they may show their respect, but deep down they know that why my wife is suffering from cancer. If God is compassionate, then where is His compassion? And I have been praying for years. Why I am poor, and the people who never pray and never come to the church or the temple or the synagogue are rich. I am honest and I am trying to be. As sincere as human frailty will permit, but I remain poor, a failure, a nobody. And the people who are mean and cunning and can do anything to achieve power and money, they are successful. And the priests go on calling God is just. Where is your justice? These things go on remaining in your unconscious. You may not say, because they may make the God very angry. In fact, in Talmud, the Jewish God says exactly the words that I am a very angry God. I never forgive. Never take me for granted. And a very beautiful sentence, that I am not your uncle, remember. That is very Jewish, but the God is Jew. You cannot do anything about it. He is reminding you, I am not your uncle. So don't expect any niceness from me. I am your father. And you know, there is a difference between the father and the uncle. Uncles are always friendly. Fathers are authority, powerful people. You belong to them. It is very rare to see a son and a father to be friendly. To be trusting each other. To be telling to each other their innermost thoughts and feelings. But you will find always many people with their uncle immensely friendly, and they will not say things to anybody which they can say to their uncles. A some different quality exists . Such a God is not only Jewish. Such a God is the God of all primitive people. In all primitive holy scriptures, He is very angry. If He was available in the world, Albert Camus is right, we would have to kill him. it will become intolerable. His interference in everything, his commandments for everything, and his anger, and his violence, and his torture. His blackmailing that he will throw you into hell fire for eternity if you don't listen to him. And if you are obedient, in other words, if you are just a slave, you will have all the joys of paradise. Such a God would not be tolerable, particularly to those who have some pride of being individuals. It will be easier to finish him. In fact, Sigmund Freud sometimes comes to very great insight. He was certainly a genius, but unfortunately these people never came in contact with any meditation. Otherwise they would have given to the world tremendous contribution. Still, because of their genius, they had glimpses and insights. In one of his insights, which may not be factual, but it is certainly psychological, and psychological is far more significant to understand than the factual, because the factual is ordinary, outside you. The psychological is within you and controls you. He says that people worship God as Father because sometime in the beginning they must have killed some dominant father, somebody who was too much dictatorial. And it is a well-known fact that many kings have been killed by their sons because the king was going on and on living and the son was becoming old and it seemed that he is not going to live as a king. The only possibility is the death of the father. Many kings have imprisoned their fathers. And took over the throne because they saw there seems to be no possibility of his natural death. At least while it is time to enjoy being a king, what will be the point when you are 75 and 80 when your father dies and you succeed? Within a year or two you will be gone too. There is a possibility, factually, but there is no historical record of it. Hence, historians have rejected the insight, but I am not a historian, and I think history is simply bunk. My concern with God is for psychological reasons. Sigmund Freud says, because somewhere in the past man has to kill the father, then he felt the guilt that what he has done, and out of that guilt he started worshipping the ancestors, the fathers, the elderly people, the old people. All this respect has arisen out of a guilt which has settled in the human heart. And he started inventing a God as father, raising temples in his memory, statues, priests praying, worshippers worshipping. Behind this whole scene and drama of religion, Sigmund Freud finds only one single fact, and that is, somewhere in the past, man has behaved with the father so badly, perhaps murdered, that he cannot forgive him. So the only way is to pray, may God, your father, the creator of the world, all these hypotheses. It was a very original insight. A man who has no guilt will not go to a church, will not go to a confessional in a Catholic church. For what? Unless one enjoys talking about so-called sins. I have heard one woman was coming every Sunday to the confessional. And confessing the same sin. That she has been raped. The bishop said that that is not your sin. You don't have to confess it. Let the person who has raped you. He said, but I enjoyed it. That's why I have to confess. I pretended to resist, but deep down I enjoyed. The priest said, even if you enjoyed, you have been forgiven, you have been donated to the charity box, and I have prayed for you to God, and this is the third time. Who is this man? Is he the same man raping again and again every week? He said, I have to confess. He has raped only once. And because I enjoyed it, he did not bother to rape me again. He looked embarrassed. What is the point? In fact, he must have felt he has been raped. Tricked. So I go in places where he hangs around. The moment he sees me, he escapes. But the priest said, if it has happened only once, then what is the point every week to come to the confession? He said, I enjoy the idea, and to tell you in detail, it is nothing to me, $10 I can give as punishment, and you can pray for my sin. But I enjoy even describing it. People enjoy. They may not have committed. My own feeling is that the number of people who confess in Catholic Church, most of them has not committed those sins. They simply enjoy the idea that I raped a woman. Perhaps they want to rape a woman, but it is a difficult job. But to confess is very simple. Just $10. And in $10, enjoying the idea that I raped the woman, at least the priest is convinced, and he will convince God too. Sigmund Freud, to me, seems to be very psychological right. Otherwise, there would be no temples, no churches, no mosques, no gods. Men needed someone to pray, needed someone to complain, needed someone to throw all responsibility on him. But if he was available in the world, just in the MG market, he would have been killed. And particularly in Pune. You will be surprised, this MG Road is named after Mahatma Gandhi. MG is the Sarge. Mahatma Gandhi Road. And Pune has killed, assassinated Mahatma Gandhi. And the day a Puneite assassinated Mahatma Gandhi, sweets were distributed. And there was celebration. And now they are calling their main market MG market. This is the guilt that somehow has to be erased. They have raised the statue of Mahatma Gandhi. It's strange. You kill the man and then you raise the statue. You must have seen on the hills, just nearby the bridge, there is one beautiful bungalow. Where Mahatma Gandhi used to stay. The people to whom that bungalow belongs used to come to listen to me in Bombay. And when I was moving to Pune, I inquired those people that that bungalow is empty. And that will be the best place because the whole hill around, the road goes round and round, and the whole hill part belongs to the bungalow. For the ashram it will be perfect, and whatever your price, he says it is not a question of price, because Mahatma Gandhi used to stay there. So we have made it a memorial. Now it is Mahatma Gandhi Memorial. There is a statue, there is a memorial. Just by the other side of the river, there is one palace, Aga Khan Palace, where British government used to imprison Mahatma Gandhi. A special concession, because it is not a jail, it is a palace. But it was used for Mahatma Gandhi whenever government wanted to put him in jail. The palace was used and he was free to move in the gardens. He was provided with his secretary, with his wife. He continued to function just as he was outside. In fact, he was in a better position. Outside he used to live in small huts because poverty was his philosophy. Here he was living in Aga Khan's palace, one of the most beautiful buildings in Pune, with a vast garden. His wife died while he was in the prison in Aga Khan Palace. His wife's samadhi is in Aga Khan Palace. So now Aga Khan Palace has also become part of a memorial because Mahatma Gandhi was imprisoned there. His wife died there. And it was a group of Hindu chauvinists of Pune who killed him. And now they are trying to somehow erase the guilt feeling. making memorials, making statues, giving names to the street. Sigmund Freud is right to my understanding that man must have behaved in the past with their elders, particularly the fathers, and there is a possibility that fathers may have been killed because they were holding all the power, and all the power included all the beautiful women of the clan. The sons were young, they needed beautiful women. The father was old, but he was holding all the beautiful women. Unless he dies, there is no possibility for the young people to have those beautiful women. They were that old man's property. Psychologists had been trying to find the same pattern in the monkeys. If you see monkeys sitting on a tree, you will be surprised. On top is the oldest monkey, the most powerful monkey. He is the president. Nobody else will be allowed to sit on the top of the tree. That is a question of prestige and power. And around him are all the beautiful females. He is old, but even the youngest females first have to be under his control. Then are underneath that other elders and underneath that are the young people. Naturally, there is every possibility, and it happens that the older monkey is killed by the monkeys because he's taking away their whole life. He has lived enough and he goes on living. And he is holding all the power. And there is a deep will to power in everybody. And particularly the power over the females. Nobody can even look at those females till the old man is alive. They don't have any other money and treasures and kingdoms, but their only property is the females. On the point of females, many old monkeys are killed. Perhaps this discovery by the scientists led to the insight of Sigmund Freud, that someday back men have killed fathers, has to kill, has to remove them, otherwise they won't allow you to live at all. If God did exist, it is absolutely certain he would have been assassinated. It will become absolutely intolerable. But fortunately, he does not exist, so nobody can assassinate him. But unfortunately, people have created a hypothetical God, which neither you can assassinate, nor you can communicate. It is simple hypothesis. But still it helps people to get rid of their guilt. The priest is the beneficiary. He keeps the hypothesis alive. He fights for the hypothesis. Because all that comes to God as offerings to erase the guilt of people reaches to the priest. So the priest's whole work is to make more and more people guilty. This is a business. And a very subtle structure. Make people guilty about everything, every pleasure. In Jainism, even to eat food tastefully is a sin. You should not eat tastefully. You can eat, but don't take the taste, don't enjoy it. That is possible only if your taste buds are operated. Otherwise, it is not possible. Your tongue and your taste buds, and they are not many, they can be removed very easily. Then you won't taste anything. But that is not the idea. The idea is that because of those taste buds, you will have to taste and then you will feel guilty. And once you are guilty, you are in the hands of the priest. Now, sex is not in your hands. Feeling good and happy with a restful night is natural. But Jainism condemns Jaina monks should eat only one time a day, and that too standing. Because being comfortably sit, you can eat more. Standing, you will get tired yourself. And it looks so embarrassing, a crowd, and you are standing, and you have to take your food in your hands. Jaina monk is not allowed to have anything as his possession. So how much you can take in your hand, and you cannot take twice. So they are hungry, and to think of food, or to think of women, or to think of any pleasure is a sin. Even to think, even to dream, and I cannot conceive that a Jaina monk can avoid dreaming the food. Our so-called celibates, Jaina, Catholics, Buddhists, Hindus, they can avoid to dream the woman. And the priests say that whether you dream or you actually act, it does not matter. Even to dream about good food is as sinful as actually eating it. Because the question is of your mentality. To dream about a beautiful woman is as sinful as having a beautiful woman. All the religious priests for thousands of years have been managing to find all those areas where you are weak, where nature can be condemned, and you cannot do anything because it is a natural thing. So naturally you will feel guilty, and guilt is the whole foundation of your religion. The priest needs you to be guilty. And because of guilt, you need God, who is going to forgive you. What are your prayers? Forgive us. We are sinners, and your compassion is great. Forgive us, Father. And there is nobody to listen to you. It is because God is just a hypothesis. Assassination is not possible. You cannot find him anywhere. Albert Camus is right. If God did not exist, we would have to invent him. That's what we have done. We have invented him. If God did exist, we would have to abolish him. The existential problem is what I have told you, is the feeling that I am unworthy. It is true, but nobody is worthy. everything we have received for no reason at all. Being grateful to existence is the only authentic religion. And it does not need to have an adjective to it, Christian or Hindu or Mohammedan. It is simply gratefulness. Vidhan, you are on the right track. Just don't get stuck at unworthiness. That is one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is gratefulness. This is the negative side. That is the positive side. Remember always to go with the affirmative, the positive. And you will never go astray. The ultimate affirmation comes the day when you explode into light, into joy, into bliss, into sound, into dance. All that will create more and more gratefulness in you. You will become just a prayer.
Beloved Bhagwan, the other morning when you mentioned about a pocket watch being the last present for people who retire, I was amazed, because when you left for America, I was at my village and I received by mail a unique present from you, a very beautiful Seiko pocket watch. I was delighted by this rare gift, but today I feel a bit shaky. Beloved Bhagwan, could you please tell me something about the significance of this gift?
Sadhya Gurdayal Singh. I remember the pocket watch that I have sent to you. I have been giving watches to hundreds of my sannyasins. The significance is simple. So you need not be worried what I said about yesterday. It was not a retirement gift. A sannyasin is never retired. he becomes enlightened. But retirement is not possible. Neither before enlightenment nor after enlightenment. Retirement does not exist in the world of a sannyasi. So you can drop your fear and worry. It was not a retirement gift. And I have been giving watches to many people, because my whole message is be watchful. So don't misunderstand me. A man in New York for the weekend struck up a conversation with a young lady in the bar. After a few drinks, he suggested that they buy a bottle and go to his room. She agreed. When the girl began taking off her clothes, the man asked, say, how old are you? 13. She replied, 13? Good Lord, said the man, get your clothes back on and get out of here. At the door, the girl paused and said, superstitious. Ah. In America, the number 13 is very superstitious. You will find in hotels that after the 12th story comes the 14th. The 13th story does not come at all, because nobody is ready to stay on the 13th floor. I have seen one book, a man had done great research work, proving that this superstition of the number 13 is not superstitious, it has a scientific background. I was very much amazed, so I went through the book. It was sheer nonsense what he has done. He has collected how many accidents happen on the 13th of day. How many people die on 13th? How many people get cancer on 13th? All kinds of calamities that happen on 13th, he has collected such a list. That anybody will be impressed greatly that certainly this number 13 is dangerous. But I wrote a letter to the man that unless you do the same research for 11th and for 12th, just two dates will do. One before 13th, and find out what happens on 12th, what happens on 11th, all the calamities. And unless you find that accidents happen more on 13th than on 12th or 11th, that more people die on 13th than on any other day, your thesis is just nonsense. This way you can prove any date dangerous, because people are dying on every date, on every day. There is no quota given to dates. But I received a letter that the man has died. Unfortunately, he died on 11th. One of his friends has replied that he himself missed 13th. But in America, that superstition is very much prevalent. People don't want number 13 on their car. They avoid the number 13 in every way. In army, you won't find a soldier whose number is 13. Sardar Gurdayal Singh that retirement watch is also a superstition. But it is possible that who invented it first may have had some idea similar to me, that now a man is retiring. Life is in a way finished. It is good to give him a watch, because days are few. Time will be rushing by faster than ever. So it will be helpful to keep him alert, watchful. Time is not money, time is life. And to give a watch, now it has become superstitious. Nobody bothers what is the meaning. Nobody knows, neither the people who are giving nor the person who is receiving. But just a golden pocket watch. But when I have given watches and I go on giving, that does not mean that you are retired. That does not mean that your days are finished. That just count on your watch. It means that be watchful. be aware and alert every moment. Is full of danger and full of ecstasy. If you can use it for awareness and watchfulness, it can become a great ecstasy. The juiciest experience of life. But if you are not aware, some moment, someday, you are going to die. Don't die before destroying your ego. Let the ego die first, so that you can realize your real immortal being. I have given you, Gurudev, just to be watchful. Because one can get into any trouble, particularly a man like Gurudev. Few days before, somebody came to me to inform that Sardar Gurudev Singh is going to marry Mukta. I said, I'm telling enough jokes and he's trying to be a practical joke. And Mukta is also great. He has found poor Sardar Gurudev Singh. He is a rare man, happy man. But to find you for marriage, and he is such a fellow, he will not say no. He has no life in many colors. He has been in the army, he has fought in the wars, he has been my bodyguard for many years. And he is of a simple and innocent heart. If somebody approaches him for marriage at this age, he will say, okay. Somehow I have persuaded Mukta not to do such a thing. Because he is living a free life, he has divorced his wife long, long ago. He has not a single worry in the world. He is one of my most profound sannyasins. Poor, but immensely rich, because he can laugh more beautifully than anybody else. I don't have to know where he is sitting. When you start laughing, I know. Because his laughter, even in his this old age, comes louder than anybody else. No need to worry about that watch. Just be watchful. Don't get into any trouble now. Getting married to Mukta, you will be in trouble, she will be in trouble. She is enjoying fully. She has divorced her husband long ago before. You have divorced your wife. Both are free. But I must say that Mukta has an eye. To find a real man. Two jokes for Sardar Gurdayal Singh. You will be poor and unhappy until you are 40, said the fortune teller to her customer. Then what? Asked the worried customer. Well, by then you will be used to it. The fortune teller replied. A man approaching retirement went along to see the company doctor for one final checkup. To his horror, the doctor said, "I don't know quite how to put this, but your heart is on its last legs and you have only got 6 months to live. Is there nothing I can do?" asked the sadhu man. "Well," said the doctor, "you can give up alcohol and cut out smoking. Don't eat any rich foods or sweets, no dancing, and don't even think about sex. And this will make me live longer?" The man asked, "Hopefully?" "No," replied the doctor. "It will just seem longer."
Yes, Bhagwan.